I kind of love that the brand name. I'm gonna butcher the pronunciation, but Jaeger LeCoultre, and then Automatique is on the dial, and then it just says Swiss made at the bottom, which I love that it's like French, French, English. At least make it automatic, you know?
I have never thought about that on a watch, and now that is going to drive me nuts. You just broke my brain.
Yeah, that's what happens when you stare at a watch for too long. You get way too pedantic.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverin, and this is Hodinkee Radio. So a couple of weeks ago, we published our 20 Teens Fantasy Draft episode, and we knew it was going to be a little controversial. We knew that there were going to be strong opinions on the watches we chose, and as it turns out, we were absolutely right. The post on Hodinkee.com quickly got over 100 comments, and we had literally thousands of people voting on their favorite watches and favorite collections. This was our most popular fantasy draft to date, and I'm not at all surprised by that. So we don't always do a real like post-mortem look back on these. Typically, we just announce the winners and then move on. But we thought it'd be nice this week. Gray's going to come on and tell Kara, James, John, and myself who won the draft. And then we're going to take a moment to look back and look at what we did, what we would change about our collections, what this taught us about the last 10 years in watches. And we're also going to try to address some questions raised by you all, the listeners, in the comments, just like we said we would. It's a really fun conversation. Honestly, this could be like a many hours long thing, but we get really into the meat of everything, and there's no shortage of hot takes either. After that, you're going to hear a conversation between Danny and myself that revisits a classic Hodinkee week on the wrist. This was my review of the Jaeger LeCoultre Master Control Date with Sector Dial, which came out almost 4 years ago. It's hard to believe it's been that long. But Danny was also a huge fan of that watch when it came out, just as a watch collector and enthusiast. And the two of us kind of talk about what it meant to the watch world and to the collector community when it came out, how the watch holds up all these years later, and the little things about the watch that we love, that drive us crazy, and that make us still want it to this day, all those years later. So we got a fun episode for you. It's really nitty gritty watch nerd stuff in the best way possible. And I know you're really going to enjoy it. So without further ado, let's do this. Hey team. Good to see you guys.
Hey everyone.
Hey guys.
Hi.
Howdy.
And this week we got our producer. We got Gray Korhonen on the mic this week.
Oh wait, Gray, you're on the mic? I thought you were just here to hang out.
Can't I do both?
All right, well, that's cool. Welcome.
I'm here to hang out, and I'll be producing as well.
Okay.
Perfect. So the reason I called you guys back is we are going to unveil the results of the 20 Teens Fantasy Draft that we did a couple of weeks ago. Gray is the only one who has seen the results. I have not seen them. I presume none of you have seen them. And so Gray is going to count us down from fourth place to first place, right?
Correct. That is the plan.
Let's maybe then just get into it, and we'll do all the other stuff after. So we'll find out who won, and then we've got some topics we want to discuss, as promised. Some big picture stuff about what we kind of learned about the last decade through doing the draft. Some more like nitty gritty things like watches we wish we could have drafted, some conspicuous absences. You know, if we had to swap some watches amongst one another, amongst ourselves. And then at the end, we're going to address some comments from the story on Hodinkee. So we asked you to let us know your thoughts, and we're going to discuss some of those today. But first up, Gray, you want to take it away and tell everybody how I won this thing?
Okay, Stephen. We didn't take a peek at the results now, did we?
I haven't seen. No, I'm just talking shit.
That,
did I win?
You totally cheated and looked.
I swear I didn't.
Oh, you're busted. That was too smooth.
Oh, man.
That was too smooth.
Yes, far, far too smooth. I agree.
Oh, shit. Yeah, I honestly didn't look.
Busted. I don't believe you.
All right, well, I'm not confirming or denying any of Steven's claims to victory, but we might as well get into the results here. After thousands of votes streamed in from all over the world, this being the most highly responded to draft poll that we have conducted so far, the results are as follows. Coming in at fourth place with 10% of the vote, drum roll please. Mr. John Buse. John Buse, fourth place.
You know what, John? There are no losers here, only winners.
What do we say? Only winners and non-winners?
I think it was winners and less winners is what we said.
Less winners.
Good day plus 29, yeah, only winners.
So John is the least of the winners. Yeah. Thanks for playing, John. Yeah. Now the third place, third least winner. Drum roll, please. Is Miss Cara Barrett, CB, with 14% of vote.
Wow, not at all an upset.
Is it?
Yeah.
I almost didn't try because I was against Cara.
All right, we're up to second place. Number two, drum roll, please. Mr. James Stacy with 32% of the vote.
Oh, okay.
Meaning that Stephen Peking Pulverant with 44% of the poll takes the crown, his second consecutive victory in Hodinkee Radio Fantasy Drafts. What do you have to say for yourself, Stephen?
You cheated.
Good to be host,
that
right?
That I didn't peak, but that I now look like a huge asshole for starting the segment that way. So
that'd be nice to be host.
I think the real lesson here is even when you're the winner, sometimes you're a loser.
Well, congratulations, Stephen. And thanks to everyone who voted. That's all I got.
Congratulations, Stephen.
Congratulations, Stephen.
Thanks, it's a solid
well
lineup.
Deserved.
It's a solid lineup. I mean, you can't. I don't think you can fault any of these collections. I mean, Gray didn't put one out there, just being shy or something. But you know, I think of the four, I think they're all pretty solid. So I get, and 44% of the vote's pretty good for one of these things.
I'd say so.
I'll certainly take that. But what I will say is, I'm shocked I got 44% of the vote. Like I feel good about my collection, obviously, but I agree with you, James. I think all of these are really solid. And I think each of these collections has at least one watch in them that to me is like a non-negotiable contender for Watch of the Decade. Mm. Like every one of these collections has one of the top 5 to 10 watches of the last 10 years in it, in a way that I don't think is up for debate, right? Like every collection has either a Rolex or Tudor flagship sport watch in it, right? Like every collection has something from Patek or Vacheron or AP that's like sort of high end and mass appeal. Like if you start to try to pick this apart, I don't know. I think the differences between the collections start to fall away a little bit. And no matter what the percentages are, like I think the margin between each of these votes is pretty razor thin.
Well, I mean, mathematically, we know the margins, Stephen. I only took my swing at that because I saw you taking a drink.
James is hoping I spit green tea all over my laptop. Yeah, this is why I'm a podcast host and not an economist. But it's why I'm not on Robin Hood. Topical.
No one should be on Robin Hood.
But I got a lot of finger guns from everybody on video when I said that, by the way, just for the listeners who are not seeing the Zoom stream. Yeah, I think, I don't know, I had a lot of fun with this draft, forget the outcome. I really enjoyed, again, as I said in the first one, like this draft really spans all of our careers. And I thought it was fun to kind of not only take a trip down memory lane for myself, but also to get sort of your perspectives on what the last 10 years in watches looked like. Like, I think I actually learned a little bit about each of you from what you picked, which considering the amount of time we spend together talking about watches is kind of astounding. But I don't know. Did you guys have any other sort of like big top line takeaways from this for yourselves, just personally?
I actually found it overwhelming because there were so many good things to choose from. And it was hard to pick. No, I also feel like we did leave some stuff out.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, there was
so many options.
There were so many things to pick from.
We could have some insane stuff off the board.
It might have been a really unwieldy podcast, but I think we could have had every single person who writes about watches for Hodinkee in on this. And there were plenty of watches to go around.
I agree.
Great. Maybe we'll have to do an extended
draft one of these days, get the whole edit team on and really go hard.
I think that would be bracket. Fun.
We can go hard. All right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just want to start this conversation by talking about kind of the big lessons about the last decade, right? Like, this was the first time, I don't know about you guys, but this is the first time I've gone back and said, like, okay, I need to go really like dig back into every year from the last 10 years, see like how collections evolved, what came out when, oh, this came before that, oh, this influenced that, this brand was doing this thing, then the designer changed and they were doing that thing. So I think there are definitely some big top level takeaways, and I'll start with one. And then I'm curious what you guys think, but I think we saw a really strong rise in budget friendly mechanical watches. And I think there are all kinds of reasons for that, not least of which is the sort of like rise of the watch internet in scare quotes. But, you know, John obviously picked the Q Timex, which is not mechanical, although Timex started making mechanical watches again in the last decade. And then James picked the Halios, which kind of represents the micro brand movement. Kara picked the System 51, which is like, you know, kind of the antithesis of mechanical watches, re-embracing mechanical watches. And then I had the Khaki Field mechanical, which I think is one of a number of efforts by big brands to come up with a sort of like appealing traditional Swiss-made watch that sits under $1,000. And there were many I could have chosen from. So I don't know what you guys think about that or if there's other trends you've noticed, but it really stood out to me that like, you are in a much better place today if you want to go spend $750 on a mechanical watch than you would have been 10 years ago.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you there. There's just so many options, like you mentioned, especially in the micro brand segment, which really took, it gave an opportunity for people to kind of like pursue their dream of like making their own watch and then have it just be out there and become like a hugely popular thing, like in the case of like the Halios C4th and watches like that. I feel like there were always kind of ETA-based, I'm saying even like, you know, in pre-Sellita days, there were the, you know, affordable ETA-based watches from smaller brands. I'm thinking like Epos and brands like that, but they were really for like super watch nerds and people reading like trade magazines or, you know, people, wandering like the, extended halls of Basel or something like that. But these like really, popular, well-designed, micro brands are still a fairly recent phenomenon.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting to think about how the vintage market has evolved over the past decade, because that's where people used to go for more affordable mechanical watches, kind of like UG, like the Pole Router and stuff like that. They used to be a lot less expensive. And then now those prices have skyrocketed because they've become more popular. But in turn, a lot of the brands have made more affordable mechanical watches to kind of balance that out. So I think it's nice because you can kind of get the best of both worlds. So I agree. I think that's a very astute observation, Stevie.
Yeah, I mean, to your point about the Pole Router, like I can speak to that personally. Like my first nice watch, quote unquote nice watch, was a Pole Router that I bought when I finished grad school as like my graduation gift to myself. And at the time, I paid $1,000 for it, and I saved up all year working my student job to be able to buy myself this watch. And I was talking to somebody the other day, I can't remember who, but since we recorded this show, the Hamilton Khaki Field Mechanical is now available on a bracelet, which is so cool. And I was saying to somebody, like, where the hell was this watch when I needed a sub-$1,000 like everyday field watch kind of watch, you know, like if that had been around, I guarantee you that's what I would have bought. And you know, I'm glad I bought the Pole Router. I'm very glad I have it. And you know, it got me into vintage and all of that. But like, there's a lot of consumers who aren't going to spend the time that I spent or put forth that kind of effort. And to have those kinds of watches, I think it's key. I really don't think we can overstate how important it is to the future of this hobby for there to be awesome watches for $100, $200, $500, $1,000. Because if you don't get people in at that point, like they may never buy, you know, they may get into something else. And the sort of like new customer flow is going to dry up.
True.
Any other kind of like big trends that we spotted? I mean, I have a couple others written down, but I'd love to hear from you guys.
I'd say that for me, what I find interesting is for 2010 to 2020, we kind of had this confluence of timing that worked out at the same point for many things. So Web 2.0 had kind of matured to the extent where we started to see the footnotes of forums becoming more the sort of conversations and knowledge that was based in forums started to transition into quote unquote more published platforms. And then a couple years later, we started to see Kickstarter and Indiegogo. And you had basically all of the little pieces that were needed if you wanted to operate as a brand, as a watch brand, but outside of the format established by the Swiss watch industry over the previous 60, 70 years. And I think that's what that decade will always stand out for me. It's where I cut my teeth in covering watches. And it was a mix of covering watches in a traditional manner, going to trade shows, learning the photography element, obviously learning how to write a sentence and the rest of it, but also while attempting just to keep up with this kind of changing landscape where like I didn't come into, I write for a magazine now with Hodinkee magazine, but that's kind of at like the tail end of the 2010s, right? Where it was like the first blog I wrote for was, you know, predates almost any blog that's still around right now. And it, you know, it doesn't have anywhere near the footing that it had at the time now that there's competition. But I think it's fascinating to see that the decade was largely won by companies that were willing to operate outside of the Rolex, Omega, Swatch realm, maybe with their movements, certainly, like John had spoken to. But it's just kind of interesting where this was a year for folks that were looking to, or a decade for folks that were looking to disrupt, whether it's in sub 1,000 like what Halios has pulled off, or almost like super hot with MBNF and all of their all the other, the rise of the big eye independents.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, that gets me to another topic I wanted to make sure we talk about, so we can just head right there, is who won the decade, right? Like, I think, you know, there's certain brands that pop up in all of our collections, or in, you know, three of the four who are the obvious answers, and we can get those out of the way. But I wanted to have at least a couple minutes of conversation about who won, like who came out the winners of the last decade. And I don't know. I mean, I think let's start where you started, James. I mean,
I think it's two, with risk takers.
Yeah. And I think it's funny. I hadn't thought about like the capital I independence, but I guess there's like the small I independence and the big I independence. And honestly, I think both did a great job.
Absolutely.
I think both moved this industry forward. I think both helped find new audiences. And I think both hopefully had some financial success, whether you're MBNF, Erwerk, Debethune, or whether you're Autodromo, Okanoskar, and Halios.
And on that point, if you're talking about kind of moving the game forward and financial success and the rest and finding a new audience, I don't think you can discredit what the auction houses did in that decade as well.
Yeah, like, that's
just
a whole
full on stars. Vintage wasn't what it is in 2010. It just simply wasn't.
Totally true.
2010, you could buy a sub for what you pay for a bracelet now, like a whole watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. What you'd pay for the bracelet, totally. What you pay for the boxes and papers, like in terms of from one item to another. I mean, everything was just down and the collectability hadn't been established. A few people knew it, obviously, the people who are seen as heroes now, they were ahead of the game. They got in when it was low and they saw the collectability of these things. And some brands are still, it's 2021 and some are still heating up. Yeah. I don't think Rolex can get hotter, but Cartier is on a great path.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's true of all people in all times interested in all things that they always feel like they kind of just missed the boat. You know what I mean? Like it's there's always that sense, but you know, it stands to reason that there is something else that's going to become incredibly hot. It's just none of us are clairvoyant, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I mean, I think the vintage thing, James, you know, that's a whole other conversation and one we should have, but I think the way in which that maybe ties back into what we're talking about today is like a lot of the brands that I think won the decade, if we're sticking to brands like modern watchmakers, are brands who saw that and ran toward it instead of away from it, or who ran away from it hard. I think it's the people in the middle who are kind of stuck. You know, if you're Max Boosser and you're like, oh, cool, people love wearing vintage Submariners. Cool. I'm not going to try to make another Submariner. I'm going to make a Sapphire opposite. Spaceship yeah. with a Tourbillon in it. And you're like, okay, cool. Yeah. Like, all right. Or your Tudor, and you're like, we're going to make an entire collection of watches that are well-priced and devoted to people who are interested in vintage watches, but want to buy something from a jeweler that they can like smash against a subway pole.
Yeah. And I think it's, we have to be careful because Tudor, I think, is a special one for this decade. This is the decade where they came back to the US. This is the decade where they really started to see a sort of playbook take effect in their market. And I genuinely believe that they're maybe single-handedly, we could identify a few other brands, I'm sure, but I think they would be the core. You know, they brought a lot of new buyers into a luxury level. Mm. People who weren't commonly spending $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a watch made that move with Tudor in the last decade.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
the crucial movement for this industry, like hugely important to transition people out of the Hamiltons, the Seikos, the Longines, and into the stuff that's like a firmly for like that, the health of the movement or the health of the whole industry is very much based on, you start in one place and you kind of bounce along as you move towards theoretically higher levels of product as you more specialize in what you like. And I think Tudor made a huge move for the whole industry by developing a product in the Black Bay that's kind of, you know, not without refute, but certainly the merits are so high. Great watches.
Sure.
Yeah, I think if... You know, there's a bunch of brands that I think you could argue won this decade, right? Like AP went from being the coolest brand in the world with every limited edition offshore known to man, and then somehow parlayed that into the success of the sort of jumbo style Royal Oaks and the concept pieces, which is, it's no small feat that they went from being the hottest thing in the world to the next hottest thing in the world without getting, you know, kind of kicked to the curb first. You know, good on them for kind of reading the tea leaves there. I mean, Rolex is Rolex. Like, you can argue that Rolex is always the brand that wins the decade. Like, nobody wins more than Rolex.
Yes, that's two like pretty complicated case studies there, because Rolex never loses. I don't think Rolex is aware that 10 years went by. I wouldn't be surprised if we one day found out that Rolex like didn't use calendars. They didn't have any use for fiscal weeks or anything that revolved around the idea of reporting earnings or successes. They just kind of like, they're moving. They're doing their own, their own market. And then AP is almost the inverse. This is a watch company based essentially in its modern context on one watch.
Yeah, agreed. Right?
And they took some swings with 1159, and they're certainly making the Royal Oak into absolutely everything that you could make the Royal Oak into, and having, you know, almost unparalleled success on that path, but two difficult brands to try and capture the market because they're operating as outliers.
Agreed. So I'm going to throw out three brands that I think those were kind of, I think you could make an argument for either one, but I don't think they actually would be my pick. I think there are three real possibilities here, and I'd love to know your thoughts, all three of you. The three contenders, I think, for the winner of the decade are Tudor, Omega, and Apple. Tudor, as James said, essentially popularized the entry-level vintage-inspired mechanical luxury watch. Like, it's a watch that is a couple thousand dollars, but it's not $8,000. It's sort of heritagey and cool, but like, you don't really need to be a watch nerd to get it. And it's Tudor. It's a big, well-respected brand. It's kind of like buying a Rolex. And the kind of like seamlessness between which you can have that discussion with like real diehard watch nerds, like guys who are spending millions of dollars a year on watches who still own modern Tudors, or like, you know, I have a bunch of friends at places like GQ who like bought their first nice watch and it was a Black Bay, you know? So that's Tudor. Omega, with the success of James Bond and the Olympics over the last decade, like, again, I know those existed before, but like, Omega did a really good job with those over the last 10 years. Plus the coaxial made its way like fully into most of the lineup. Like most of their flagship level watches at this point have coaxial escapements, and they rolled out the METIS certification. So like from a watchmaking perspective at scale, maybe it's Omega. And then the last one is Apple. The Apple Watch came out in the last decade. It's the most worn watch in human history. Nothing in the history of wristwatches has gotten more people to talk about and focus on the wristwatch, at least in the modern era, than Apple. And so, like, it's probably not the way we want to call the game here, but, like, I think it's at least worth having that conversation.
Yeah. I agree with all your picks.
Yeah, I wouldn't change any of those picks, to be honest. And I think with Tudor in particular, and just kind of, like, I guess going to James' point, he's the one who brought it up. I mean, there's a reason why I picked the Black Bay Burgundy as, you know, my first pick out of the draft. And it's because, you know, I just remember that moment in like, it was like 2012, 2013, when Tudor came back to the USA. And it felt like, you know, to me anyway, it felt like the aspirational kind of like the aspirational entry point to the world of Rolex was almost cooler than Rolex itself. And that's like almost like sacrilegious to say, but like I did, there was that feeling for a moment there because what they were doing was so like revolutionary, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that was our first overall
pick.
Yeah, that right?
I think so.
Was it?
I mean, it's an MVP of a watch for sure to be with it. And then the other side of it is like, at least it, like let's say in 2010 it wasn't quite as hard to buy a Rolex. 2012 not quite as hard, but the Black Bay kind of came out in time to be in the market and to have some critical reviews and to have sort of a watershed moment as Rolex became, I don't know, almost unbuyable. I mean, everybody can get, like, theoretically everybody someday will get the Rolex they want, but you're just gonna have to wait for it. And and I think a lot of this market, like, people don't always want to wait. And I think that the other thing that's kind of fun is I think the willingness to wait on an $8,000 or $9,000 watch is different than the willingness to wait on a $3,000 or $4,000 watch, which really worked in their advantage.
Yeah.
Yeah. I totally agree. I guess if you each had to pick from those three brands who won the decade, who would you say won the decade? If you had to pick.
I'm going to be controversial here and say Apple. It was the first time they came out with a wristwatch, and it really did reinvigorate the conversation. I've had so many conversations with people who said that they didn't know anything about watches and they bought an Apple Watch, and then they didn't like wearing it anymore. So then they went and started reading about other watches because they liked having something on their wrist, and that's how they got into it. And I think it's really created a very strong narrative around the wristwatch. I mean, let's get real. I mean, I think 10, 15 years ago, like, watches were still kind of like under the radar, and now they're way more mainstream. And I think Apple has a lot to do with that.
I think 2010 was a hugely important watch decade for Apple. I'm not sure how important Apple was to the overall decade of watches. I think that
that's
like
fair.
The Apple Watch or the creation of a kind of ubiquitous and highly adopted smartwatch was inevitable, and I get it. And I think I genuinely hope that it's pointing people towards traditional watchmaking. You know, I hope to have a career in this industry that goes for a little bit longer. And the prevalence, the power of the Apple Watch could theoretically change the way the whole industry goes. But I don't know in my mind that, you know, the same sort of accolades for Omega or Tudor couldn't be shared by Apple and vice versa. So it's, in my book, it's definitely not Apple. It's really tough because it's Tudor for product and it's Omega for tech.
I mean,
they took a tech that a lot of people were just like flatly ignoring and even downplaying. And not only did they commercialize it, they made it very successful. They offer huge warranties on a tech that a lot of companies were really afraid to touch.
Yeah.
I think they did a huge thing.
I think it's those are really good points. I think it's really depends on like what you're looking at, right? So if you look at like where Omega is now compared to where they were in like let's say like the late '90s, I think it's like they were always huge. They're always one of the big brands, but like what they're doing now is so much more impressive. If you look at like I have an Omega chronograph that I own. It's my only Omega, but it's like, you know, it's got a Valjoux 7750 based movement in it. It's like not knocking that movement. It's a great movement. And now you look at like, you know, what their bread and butter stuff is in terms of like the amazing automatic calibers, but then of course, like with like the 3861 and like bringing back the 3-2-1, it's just like, they have come so far in the last 20 years as a brand, I think, as like a high-end watchmaker. It's actually incredible. And then you add on top of that, like the, as Stephen was mentioning, like the Metis and all of the coaxial stuff. And it's just like, that has been a seriously impressive brand evolution, actually, as a high-end watchmaker. Yep. And then just, in, you know, yeah. Tudor coming back to the US. And then, of course, Apple didn't make watches. So they kind of, they entered the category. So everything that they built was from nothing. You know?
Yeah.
I have a question. Do we think fashion watches have a place in the past decade?
It was a big decade for Daniel Wellington and the Kors.
Michael
one.
Kors. That's yeah. kind of what yeah, I was yeah, thinking. Yeah. Like, unless fashion.
That's an interesting thought.
It's very true. I would say my only caveat there would be that, like, we know that, like, Apple has really hurt those sales. That, like, they had a huge spike right as the Apple Watch was coming out, and basically every year since, it's been tough. Like, those companies are fighting an uphill battle when for, like, $100 more, instead of a Daniel Wellington, you get an Apple Watch. So I think you're right, Cara.
Like the rise and fall.
But I think they had like the full bell curve. Like they spiked and are, you know, maybe it's a shifted bell curve. We're not like all the way at the bottom of the other side, but I think we're on the downswing for sure. I think I'm gonna vote Omega. It's tough. Omega and Tudor are neck and neck for me. I think my reason for going with Omega and not Apple is that in the context of what we do and the audience we're speaking to, there's a certain contingent of watch lovers for whom the Apple Watch is just like not even worth talking about. And I disagree with those people. I urge those people to like take 10 minutes and like go read about the thing, or like when it's safe again, go see one. Like, you don't even have to go buy it. Just like go see it and play with it for 5 minutes. I think you'll change your tune. I think at least a little bit. But I think Omega ticks all the boxes. I think that between the Olympics and James Bond, they are woven into the fabric of like major cultural events, sporting events, and sort of like media events. I think like your average person who doesn't know anything about watches, like probably if they saw a Speedmaster would be like, oh, I've seen that before. Like it has like some sort of currency. And then I think they've done a really incredible job building for both mass market and the enthusiast community at the same time in a way that like nobody else is doing. And I think, you know, we forget often sometimes that like they are a close second to Rolex in terms of like the biggest watchmaker in the world, the biggest luxury watchmaker in the world. And think about how crazy it would be if like Rolex were to come out with a box set that was recreations of the Big Crown, the Day-Date, and the Explorer, you know? Yeah. Think about how crazy it would be if every Rolex had a display back, a beautifully finished movement, and a coaxial escapement inside. Like, that would be nuts, and everybody would be going totally batshit over it. And I think Omega has, like, weirdly been able to do all this stuff and be kind of, like, low-key about it, which I really respect, and also kind of like, I wish they got more recognition for it. So I don't know, for me, from the like pop culture to the enthusiast, the technical, the aesthetic, the historical, the modern, like, I don't know. I think Omega takes the cake. And the funniest thing about this for me is that there's not a single Omega in any one of our collections, which is kind of a nice transition to what I wanted to do next, which is, you know, kind of go back and ask some questions about our draft and see what we would have done the same, differently, whatever. But
maybe some rapid fire stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So let's just do some rapid fire. You don't need to explain too much because we got, you know, a good amount to get through and not a ton of time left. But let's start there. if you had to, and we'll go, let's just go in the same order just to keep it easy. We're going to go in the order that everybody's in my Zoom chat. So we'll go John, Kara, James, me, if that works. Let's start with which watch from your collection would you never give up or trade if we were to do the draft over again?
Which watch would I never give up or trade? I would keep the, can I say two or does it have to be one?
No.
Okay. You gotta I would never give up the Creedor, which is funny because I think that's the one that I picked kind of like on the spot. I think that's one that I just kind of was like, oh, I need something from, you know, from that kind of type of watchmaking. I should do this. But looking back on it, that's one that I would not give up.
Nice. CB?
The Rainbow.
Not at all surprised.
It's just too fancy.
For me, yeah, I think it's one of one. So it'd be the Corey Richards Vacheron in titanium. Yeah. So, I mean, if you could get something like that, that could just be, I could live the rest of my life in the watch industry with that one watch to my name and it would be fine. I'd be doing real good.
Yeah. I funnily feel the same way about the watch I'm going to pick, which is probably in terms of winning me this draft, the least responsible watch. Like this is strategically the worst pick, but I'm going to pick the Acrivia, the Chronomet Contemporan.
The stick watch.
Again, like I,
like, that is like a one watch for you though. Like
dude,
long as I've known you, and then certainly as long as I've been working for and with you, this watch has been like a major thing for you.
It's huge. And the fact that like Recep is like my age ish and like a nice guy, you know, I've been to the workshop a couple times, hung out and had beers. Like it's like all the things I love about being in the watch industry, like having those personal connections and seeing like a person who is really fully devoted, like in their entire being to making great things. And the fact that it like lines up with my own taste is
also representative of the independence, which had a big success in the past decade.
Exactly.
For sure.
Exactly. All right, let's go to the next one. If you could add another wild card pick, so you get any watch, you just have to add a sixth watch to your collection to round it out in whatever way you want. What's your sixth watch going to be?
Is this a Serpentine? Can I go first?
Sure. Technically, I would go first if we were doing it as a...
I'm just confusing things. Oh, yeah, sure enough. Yeah, you're up. You go first. Steven, let me know what the watch you would add if you had another wild card pick.
I'm going to go with the 321 Speedmaster from Omega, the Ed White. My point from before, like Omega had such a killer decade. And like, yes, this watch is not the most technically advanced Omega. It's not a new design. Like, it's not a lot of the things I said that make Omega great, but it is that sort of like fan service combined with technical prowess. And so I'm going to go 321 Speedy. James, what would you pick in this Serpentine draft?
So glad you asked. RM2701.
Ooh,
baby.
Was the other big stinker I had in my wild card list. It's one of the most fabulous things I've ever held in my hands.
I could not agree more, my friend.
It just makes you laugh. It makes you feel like you're 5 years old and somebody showed you, like, it reminded me of the first time someone showed me Indiglo on a Timex.
Yep.
I was six. It was like the sickest thing I had ever seen. Like, not the sickest thing someone had ever, like a button someone had pressed and something happened. Indiglo is the sickest thing I had ever seen.
Yeah, dude.
And like you get around an ultra lightweight R. Any Richard Mille is an incredible thing to for somebody to hand you to hold on to for a moment. But the ultra light stuff and then the Nadal stuff is just on a whole different level.
It breaks your brain. Like you pick it up and your brain doesn't understand how an object of that volume can have that little mass. Mm-hmm. And you just like it, like you do a double take and you have a hard time. Like it's weird. It's a weird sensation. And I highly recommend anyone who hasn't held one of these, like find a retailer, go in and like be super friendly to the people and see if they'll let you put one on your wrist or even just hold it. It's crazy. It's a crazy experience.
Yeah.
CB, how about you?
I'm going to do the MB&F Flying T. Even though it came out recently, I think, it represents a lot of things. One, an independent. Two, a really cool independent. Three, it's the first ladies watch that MB&F did, quote unquote ladies. It's not super specific, but that's who it's intended for. And I just think they knocked it out of the park. And I think it kind of just showcases what Max is so good at doing, and creating something crazy that you can wear. So
love it. Great watch.
Good pick.
John, you want to finish it off?
If I could pick something different, I think I probably would, like you, have gone for an Omega, and it would be a Speedmaster, but I'd go for, I'd probably do a 3861.
Yeah, John, I totally agree with that. That's awesome. And specifically, I assume when you say 3861, you're talking about the gold Speedy?
Yeah, exactly. The one that came out approved decade.
You like how I gently nudged you there in the right direction? Yeah. James, what's your pick going to be? What were you surprised nobody took?
Yeah, I'm surprised that we didn't see any MB&F, right? And you know, Carr sorted a little bit with the T. And the other one is like Harry Winston Opus stuff, which is again a precursor to MB&F, right? That was Max's project with them. And I'd like the Opus 11 was on my list. I think it's still one of the wildest watches I've ever seen. The best animation of a watch I've ever seen. But for me it would be, you know, any of the kind of big sort of hallmark Royal Oaks. You know, they just demanded so much attention over the last decade, especially the last 5 years. So I'd probably like the RD2. It's a pretty remarkable watch from basically every level of watchmaking. And then of course it's completely impossible to buy. So
yeah.
How are you feeling? What do you think for ones we missed?
Yeah. I think it's funny, like, you know, you and James and Cara, you two went in one direction, which was like more like impact on the industry, high complication, like impressive stuff. And I think John went for like a really great consumer friendly watch that like, I bet you hundreds of thousands were sold over the last decade. Like you'd have to imagine that hundreds of thousands of Speedmasters were sold. So I'm going to go in that direction. I was shocked, and again, I know John picked the Black Bay Burgundy. I was shocked that the BB58 wasn't on this list. I just remember at Baselworld when this watch came out, people lost their shit. Like, the watch media is pretty jaded and cynical by nature, like even more than most consumer journalists are. I feel like watch people are pretty finicky. People lost their damn minds over this watch. Like, you would have thought Rolex was handing out fucking big crowns at the booth. Like, it was insane. People were going bananas. Like, people wearing six-figure watches on their wrists were freaking out and calling their ADs to try to get this, $3,200 watch, $3,300 watch. I don't know. I think it's one of the biggest splashes I've seen a watch make. And I was kind of shocked we didn't find a spot for it. So
it's also kind of shocking because I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. All three of you own that watch, right?
I love that watch.
Yes,
I do.
That is true. Yeah. All three of us do own this watch.
Maybe that was the miss. I don't own an RM2701.
Okay, James.
It's on payment. Sure, it's on payment.
Sure you don't.
It's on payment. It'll only take me another like 32, 33 years to pay for it.
It's a piece unique too, right?
Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Clear carbon.
All right, cool. All right, let's do one more. And this is kind of a weird one, but I thought it'd be fun. It doesn't really have anything to do with the draft specifically, but like, why the hell not? If we let you add one watch to this collection that was not a new watch released, but was a vintage watch or a modern watch sold at auction over the last 10 years. So it changed hands. There was an opportunity in theory for you to purchase it over the last 10 years. Which auction watch would you add to your collection? Well, I guess by virtue of the snake draft, what? I should start it?
I think so.
All right, so my pick, this was a no-brainer for me. It's, I don't think, going to shock anyone who has ever met me, read anything I've written, or listened to a single word of this show. I'm going to pick the Philippe Dufour Duality number 00.
Okay.
Which sold at Phillips in the same auction as Paul Newman's Paul Newman, which is bananas that happened, that those two watches sold in the same sale. I remember seeing them both at the Philips preview in LA. And honestly, you put the two watches side by side, and I could not have cared less about Paul Newman's Daytona. The duality is insane. It's like the manifestation of Philippe Dufour's like absolutely astounding brain and technical skills. I don't know. I this watch is everything I love about watchmaking and then some. And to have even been able to like hold this watch and put it on my wrist for a little while was pretty awesome. So yeah, I mean, the watch ultimately sold for just under $1 million. It sold for $915,000. And that's in October 2017. I think if it's sold today, it would easily clear $1 million, maybe clear $2 million, just because of where the market's at. But yeah, this was a no-brainer. Like, in fact, I wrote this question so that I could have an excuse to talk about this watch on the show.
Oh, good pick. It's a sweet watch.
What's your pick, James?
So this is a watch that has to have been auctioned in 2010 to 2020?
Yeah. It has to have come up for sale at some point during the decade.
Yeah, the one I really want is 2008, so I'll make a small adjustment to, let's see, 2016. It would be Briggs Cunningham's piece, Unique 1463, steel, black dial, luminous markers.
Great choice.
2008 is his arguably cooler 1526 with the black hands and markers on a white dial, which went for $4 million in 2008. So like, who knows? It could be almost any number now. But for ones within that decade, yeah, a Briggs Cunningham piece Unique Patek, I think would be sick.
Yeah, James, that's a super, super solid choice.
It's a fun watch.
Yeah, it's a fun watch. that's like the understatement of the year so far.
Later.
Yeah. CB, what's your fun watch pick?
I'm doing another Patek, actually. I'm going to pick the titanium officer case watch that had Breguet numerals. I can't remember what the reference is. Titanium.
This is not the titanium one with the diamond in the case back?
Yeah.
Oh, it is that one. Okay.
That's the one.
Oof.
It's really cool. And I think, what year was that? Gosh, 2014.
Yeah.
I think it was 2014. Anyways, it was really amazing. And I think about it a lot.
You worked on that sale, right?
I did. I wish I could see that watch again. That's one that I just don't think I'll ever see. It was so cool.
Yeah, I agree.
It had the table cut diamond. I talk about it all the time, but table cut diamond on the case back so you can see the movement through the diamond. Because who knew that that's what you...
God. So awesome.
Like who would I... To be a fly on the wall in that meeting.
Man, that's like... That's straight to the front of the guillotine line kind of shit. Like, when the revolution happens, whoever commissioned that watch, they are first. That is some crazy shit, but I love that watch.
So cool.
John, all right, what's the last one here? What would you add to your collection?
So this just has to have been sold at auction during this decade that we're talking about. That's the only rule. I'm gonna take the Bao Dai. I think that's just like an awesome watch.
Ooh,
it was for a brief time in 2017 the most expensive Rolex, right? And then before Paul Newman quickly came in toward the end of the year and took it over. But it's just like, I mean, I'm looking at it right now. I'm looking at actually at Arthur's article about it from 2017. And yep, this is what I'm going to take.
Great choice. Cool. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. I mean, we had a lot of other stuff we could have chatted about here, but I think we're out of time. If we didn't answer your question, head over to the site, drop it in the comments. So just go to hodinkee.com. This will be on the homepage or somewhere easily findable. And or you can click through in the show notes and go through and leave us comments. And we'll all be checking the comments. We'll leave replies for you there. There's just not enough time to cover everything right here on air. But thank you guys for doing this. I love doing these drafts. We'll do another one soon enough, next, you know, couple of months. And maybe I won't win next time.
We'll see.
You guys like that humble brag there at the end? We'll was that good?
Yeah. That was subtle.
That was a chef's kiss of humble brag right there.
Thanks for having us
awesome.
On, Stevie.
Thank you guys, and thanks for putting up with me accidentally spoiling the draft and then being smug about it.
Right. Thanks, Stevie. You deserve awesome. It.
Thanks, everyone who voted.
Thanks, guys. Up next, Danny and I revisit a classic Week on the Roost. Hey, Danny, how's it going, man?
Hey, Steven. It's going well. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm good. It's good to have you here on A Week on the Roost Revisited. And I say that somewhat selfishly because this week we're actually going to do a review that I did, which I guess a little weird. I'm like bringing you on to talk about my story, but I hope you're game. I hope that's cool.
Yeah, who's picking these? Who's in charge of the selection process here? It's a little suspicious.
Yeah, it's funny. This one actually came about because we realized that we're coming up on 4 years since this was done. Gray, our wonderful producer, this is one of the first videos he worked on when he joined the Hodinkee team. It was the first time he and I worked together. So this review holds kind of an important place in the mythology or the lore of Hodinkee Radio. But
this is a milestone Week on the Roost.
Yeah, man. It's an important one, and it's one that, like, I'll be totally honest, this watch, which we'll introduce in a second, this is the rare watch that, like, I find myself thinking about this watch not infrequently, which, considering the volume of watches you and I both see in our day-to-day, is something to take note of, for sure.
I'm with you. I think I've watched that video more than double digits times, because it's just one of those watches you want to looking at. You want to, but it's like that whole ASMR weird thing that goes on these days. You just want to pretend you have it, and the only way you can do that's through a Week on the Roost sometimes.
Yeah, there's also certain watches I find where, like, watching them in motion, there's sort of a, like, visual ASMR component where, like, there are certain things about the watch that just, like, they're the things where if you owned it, you would end up, like, staring at your wrist while you're supposed to be paying attention to your boss in a meeting and look like a total asshole. But if you don't have that, you instead kill time at your desk watching one of our reviews, watching the watch go back and forth.
I got to hand it to you. You're very good at the, like, holding the watch in your hand and turning it when you're doing a review of a watch, which is, you know, it is a Week on the Roost, but that's the kind of thing that I feel like anybody with a watch is just doing half the time. I find myself taking my watch off and just, like, checking it out in a different light, or just, like, what does it look like in the palm of my hand, or just, like, random things like that.
Yeah. We'll get into this watch in a second, but I do find myself, there's one watch in particular. I have a vintage Grand Seiko that I find myself, like, putting on a table and then, like, looking at, like, crouching down to look at it perfectly side on so I can see, like, the edges of the case. But yeah, the camera work in this video, like, I upon rewatching this, I don't tend to go back and rewatch my own reviews, like, over and over and over again. I'm not quite that vain. We're close, but not quite.
Wouldn't blame you for it.
But rewatching this one, it's the first time I'd seen it in probably over a year, maybe a year and a half or 2 years even, and the production quality on it's fantastic, which, like, I have nothing to do with. That's purely Gray and Will and the video team. But it was so cool to see how well this watch held up, and now we'll kind of, like, we'll introduce the watch. I mean, it's been intro in the segment before, but this is the Jaeger LeCoultre Master Control Date with Sector Dial. It's kind of a cumbersome name, but it's the Sector Dial JLC is what we're talking about here.
Right.
And this watch came out at SIHH 2017, so basically 4 years ago this week or last week. And it was one of those watches that, like, we were still new enough in the vintage-inspired kind of, like, heritage reissue world there that, like, people still paid attention. Like, it was a big deal that JLC went back in their archive and found something and, like, recreated it into this special edition. The deal was it was originally, I think, only going to be available at boutiques. I think they may or may not have lifted that. And it was originally going to only be available for a year, and they extended that as well because they couldn't produce nearly as many as they had demand for in a year. So they extended that. I think it was produced for 2 or 3 years. But Yeah, the watch I reviewed is part of a trio. You know, there was the time and date version, which is what I reviewed. There was a chronograph, and there was the geographic, which is the GMT. Right. And we went for the simplest one. The kind of historical background here is Jaeger found a chronograph in their archive with this sort of two-tone silver dial with blue accents. And that was the inspiration for this collection. Then they sort of scaled it both up and down to more complicated and less complicated. Were you paying attention to this when it launched? Like, do you remember this watch coming out?
Yeah, so for sure. And not just that, but you get this feeling from, especially from a brand like JLC, where its reputation is being sort of the watchmaker's watch. When you see this watch, it kind of hits you. Is so obviously good looking. Like, sometimes a watch, you just kind of see it and you know, like, oh, it's simple, but it works. And when I saw this watch, it kind of didn't seem like something the JLC would do in a weird way. It's kind of like half sport watch, but half like super classic, you know, circa 1930s design aesthetic. That's kind of just like, where did that come from? And so, like, for me, that it hit on these two kind of like converging paths. So when I was just a viewer at the time, it was one of those things where I was like, whoa. And that's why I've rewatched that video, you know, more than one time. It kind of does that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, like, my take on this watch at the time, to put it simply, was this thing is freaking great. And if you're at all inclined to buy it, you should. Like, if you see this watch, you think you want it, you probably do want it. And you're probably going to be really happy if you buy it. You know, I had some caveats there, which is like, I hated the straps these watches came on, right. Which is like a complaint I have with many watches. They come out, you know, you buy an $8,000 watch and it comes on like a garbage strap. They came out of like a giant factory somewhere. Not my thing. But other than that, like, I didn't really have too many gripes. And looking back at the review, I can't really think of many new ones, which we'll go through in a second when we break this thing down in categories. But I don't know. I mean, I think the review itself stands up pretty well. I'm pretty happy with it.
It's straightforward in the best way, because I think you're looking at this watch and you can kind of tell you like it, but you're letting everybody know, like, each thing in turn, like, what this watch is offering you. And it's important, because sometimes we do reviews and it's easy to just kind of take for granted a lot of things that are going on a particular watch, and you see it and you kind of internalize the stuff and you kind of give a, you know, less than deep, you know, information dump on video. But for you, I was really appreciating, you went from every single section: material, color, hands, dial, case. I mean, it's all like, that watch is offering you so much. And like you're saying, there was a sense of urgency around that. I mean, it's a special edition. It wasn't a limited edition, but if you did want it, like, the clock was, you know, not to make a weird pun, but the clock was ticking. You should buy it if you want it. I'm a little upset that I didn't, but like, yeah.
Yeah, me too. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But I mean, to your point about structure, like, let's just jump into that then. Like, let's go through. We have some categories. You know, we don't use the same categories for every watch we do this with. Each review is different depending on who the author is, when we produced it, the type of watch, all of that. But we've put together some categories here, and Danny, I'll throw them out, and then we can kind of hash it out together. I'm sure. Really interested in bringing your perspective to bear on this thing I did, you know, a million years ago. I guess the first thing is, like, if you, I've done it, so I'm going to let you do it here. Like, if you had to give an elevator pitch on this, what would that be? So in this case, like, let's say it's 30 seconds or less on the clock for you, and like, you've got to tell somebody what this watch is and why they do or don't want it. I am looking at my rolling clock now, and go.
All right, we're not talking about Rolex, we're not talking about Patek. You've got a simple, no nonsense watch with a date. It's kind of a sport watch, it's kind of a dress watch, could be your one watch for life. I think that's my elevator pitch on this one.
Dude, you hit that in like 11 and a half seconds. I am impressed, and I also wouldn't add a single thing. I think that is the exact perfect perspective here. And I like where you started. I mean, I think, like, you know, it's really easy in you know, it's really easy as we look back at the last couple of years and think that there are only like four or five watch brands that quote unquote matter, right? It's like everything is like a Rolex, an Omega, a Patek, a Richard Mille, an AP, like whatever. It's the same 5 to 10 brands. And like often JLC probably wouldn't be on that list, and that would be a shame. I agree. JLC is doing super interesting stuff. They make exceptionally high quality watches for the price. And I think, you know, even if we set aside what JLC is, I think acknowledging that in some ways, if you buy a luxury watch in the $5,000 to $10,000 range in steel and it's not a Rolex, you're making a statement. You're saying, I had the money to buy a Rolex and everyone knows about Rolex. Everyone would know I was wearing, quote unquote, a nice watch, whatever. And I made a different decision.
Yep.
And that's cool. Like, I think there's actual currency there. And this is one of those watches, like, when I was wearing it, people wanted to know what it was. And, like, my friends are used to me wearing silly watches all over the place. And, like, most of the time, they don't even ask. Like, they're not even, like, they are not curious anymore. That has become old, you know? The first time I showed up to, like, you know, a bar wearing a Lange on loan, people were like, what? What the hell are you doing?
Right.
Now nobody gives a shit. But this is one of those watches. Like, I got asked about by non-watch people, and it was a great opportunity to be like, hey, there's this thing called JLC, and it's dope, and you should know about it.
And their movement history. I mean, it's one of those brands where you can get deep. Like, you can justify, not that you have to, but I think it helps a lot of people to have to justify why they make that decision as you get close to that $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 mark, and logically some people's brains just go, oh well, at this point I'll just spring for a Submariner, or I'll spring for a Datejust because it's Rolex. But you can justify JLC as the movement that's been in some of the most well-known brands that you would wear, you know, historically speaking. I mean, that's why they call them the watchmaker's watch brand. I mean, their movement history is so deep. So I can, similar to like a Zenith, you can really make the case for those kind of brands when you get into that universe.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, you mentioned the movement, and that's one thing I said earlier, and we're breaking the categories a little bit here, but I do think this is important.
Who's counting?
Yeah, exactly. We make the rules, right? You know, I said earlier I don't have many gripes, and I would say the one thing that, looking back at this watch, that if you had asked me to kind of like picture it in my mind's eye where it didn't quite match up was the movement finishing. And I think Jaeger has been known as, you know, their movement architecture is amazing across the board. Like, the technical side of the calibers is exceptional, from the least expensive to the most expensive. The finishing varies greatly. You know, if you want to buy a high complication from JLC, you can get finishing up there with anything, you know, really, really anything.
Sure.
When you get to the more accessible price point, you're certainly getting much better finishing and a lot more handwork than you're getting with something like an ETA movement, even an Elaboré grade ETA movement, or something from Sellita or whatever. But, you know, looking at this movement, yeah, it has a gold rotor, you know, it's got blued screws, and like, they're not fake chemical bluing, like they're real heat blued screws. And like, that's cool. I think we've all gotten spoiled the last couple years with movement finishing, especially on the like more accessible price point. And so the movement didn't wow me quite as much, but that doesn't actually make me want the watch any less, if that makes sense.
Does it make the case, because we're going to get into this later, about why, I mean, a brand like Rolex, you come back to why sometimes there's no shame, despite the movement itself, of having a closed case back. I mean, at a certain level, that's the thing that you're we talked about taking your watch off and looking at it in your hand, but when you're wearing your watch, you're not looking at that. I mean, I tend to be on different sides of the fence depending on the watch, but at $5,700, we know what the movement's doing for you. But this watch is all about sort of that style aesthetic on the front end. So I don't know what your thoughts are on would this watch have been better with a closed case back versus open?
Danny, I have spent dozens of hours thinking about this watch, and it never occurred to me that was like a swap we could make. And I guess it's because, like, first time around, like, I thought the movement looked great, and I still think it looks great. I'm just not wowed by it. And I love the idea of this with a solid case back. Maybe it shaves another like 0.2 millimeters off the thickness and makes it even thinner, which is already one of the best things about this watch.
Exactly.
And then you get to be that guy who's like, oh yeah, it's it's, you know, yeah, it's a mechanical watch, but like, yeah, I don't have to show you anything. Like, I don't owe anyone anything. Which that's interesting. I like that, Danny. I like where your head's at. Let's go back to the categories. Let's do first up, first thing. What is the first thing you notice when you see or hold this watch?
Well, from inside baseball perspective, first thing I noticed was like huge stunt on your part, just like swapping out the strap. It was a great move, I have to say. Just like taking a watch this cool and being like, you know what? This would look cooler. This watch would look even better if I put this strap on, accentuate the dial features. Because honestly, sometimes like contrast can be too contrasty. And the blue aesthetic on the watch, you don't need a blue strap. Like, it's almost like too obvious. And I probably wouldn't lean to wearing a blue strap as an everyday option. And I think that the choice you picked really accentuated what I do first notice when I look at this watch, which is just like that soothing sector dial where it's the different shades of silver against that blue. It just, it's such a calming watch. The watch just like feels so calming. That's what I notice about this watch.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's a great point. Yeah, the strap thing was a controversial choice in the Hodinkee office. You know, we had a lot of discussions about whether or not throwing a new strap, which is, you know, this is a couple $100 strap. This is not like an inexpensive strap. And like, is it kind of cheating? Like, are we grading on a curve here? Would it be like, you know, test driving a car, but swapping out the wheels or something, you know, like that doesn't really count. So we talked about it and we figured, you know what, like most consumers these days are savvy enough to do this. If you're spending, you know, the full price of this watch, the strap's not a big difference. So we decided to go with it. And it's something that ended up making its way into other reviews down the road and is now kind of a part of what we think about when we review a watch, is how to best present the watch itself. I think for me, the thing I noticed first, honestly, is the subtleties of the dial. You know, like you said, this watch has a soothing quality to it. And I think part of why it has that is because, yes, it's contrasty, but all of the surfaces have depth. You know, the center pearled part has this almost like, it's not like sandpaper, but it has like a grain to it, like a very subtle grain to it. And the silver track has this radially brushed, kind of circular brushed finish to it. And those details, and even the way that the date window is cut, like you get this really nice tiny bit of shadow on the date disc, like just enough to give you the impression of depth, but not so much that it looks like it's, you know, sunk to the back of the movement. Those subtleties really grab me. And again, just looking at this watch first thing as I was scrolling through pictures of it, it's like I just wanted to zoom in and zoom in and zoom in. Like I just found myself wanting to get deeper and deeper into the watch. So yeah, that's what kind of gets me first looking at it. You know, we'll move along here. What's the best design choice made about this watch? What is the decision they made that could have gone wrong, but it broke right? They did a great job.
So this watch is sandwiched between, you know, its predecessor in the Master Control line and now the current Master Control date. And both of them each do the same thing, which is they have applied numerals. And so for me, painting the numerals on the dial could have gone very wrong. A, because when you start doing that, you run the risk of being too vintage evocative, you know, sort of trying too hard to go that route. But there is a simplicity to how it's done on this watch, which for me, those numerals make the watch in so many ways. It's just sort of like, I love, you know, old matte dial Rolex watches because there's no white gold surrounds around any of the markers. It's just, you know, painted markers. And I love that this watch did that. And because they did it in black, and because the whole dial is done in silver, and because it has this kind of like color motif, that it just kind of worked for me. But it's one of those things where it could easily go either way.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I think kind of positioning it that way between the other watches in JLC's collection emphasizes that this was purposeful. Like this wasn't just they did what they were doing. They made a conscious decision here. And I have to say, I think Jaeger does a better job at that than a lot of watchmakers. Like I know many of the folks at JLC. I've visited the factory multiple times. I've sat with the design team. Like I know those folks, I would say, pretty well. And and I have nothing but respect for them. And I think they do a really good job that even when they're sort of like designing by committee, like all of these, you know, larger watch brands do, like they're real designers at the table. And there's people who have like a deep respect for the product across the organization. You know, I have in the past under previous leadership there, you know, I haven't visited under current leadership, but under previous leadership, like I've been in the factory when the CEO is walking down the watchmaking benches, you know, making comments on how movements are being assembled and asking questions about dial furniture. And like that brand has through many regimes managed to maintain that sort of like deep respect for the product. And I think narrowing in on the numerals is a great way to demonstrate that kind of broader point.
It's actually a point that I find a lot of watches, it seems to sometimes be the last thing that was thought. At least that's how it comes across. It's like the dial design in general is great, texture's great, case is great, but it's like not a lot of thought went into, I don't think it's technically called a typeface when you're talking about numerals, but not a lot of thought goes into like the design of how those, you know, are approached when they're put on the dial. And I think it's extremely important. You really bond with a watch. You look at it all the time. You want everything to be thought through. And that's why that's one of my favorite parts on this watch.
Yeah. I'm going to go with a similar choice. I'm going to go with the blue accents on this watch. They're controversial. I know some people don't like them. Some people think they're too bright. Some people think the whole dial should have been monochrome. Whatever. Like, sure. Like, I think the watch still would have been great in any of those directions. But I think this little bit of brightness and levity is really nice. And I think it takes what could be a vintage homage piece in a very basic, straightforward sense, and it injects something new. And it says, like, you know, yes, of course, there have been light blue accents on dials going back forever. Like, I'm not saying they invented something, but, like, you know, they weren't producing the same sort of, like, historical referent that everybody else would have produced. And again, it just shows that they're paying attention, and that thoughtfulness is important to me.
No, I agree 100%. I mean, the blue makes this watch. I mean, it's the other, like the general master control date is a very monochromatic grayscale design. And this adds the contrast of the black plus the blue. And it's what makes this particular model as unique as it is.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to the opposite side of the coin here. What's the thing you'd change? What do you think they kind of like biffed or like a missed opportunity?
I kind of touched on it. I still think closed case back would have been a really cool move on their part. I think it's kind of, you know, what makes Rolex kind of cool in its own way. It's like, yeah, our movements are awesome. You can go ahead and take it off and take a look, but we're just not showing them to you. But in a funny way, I kind of love that. Obviously the brand name, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, but JJ LeCoultre, and then Automatique is on the dial. Mm-hmm. And then it just says Swiss made at the bottom, which I love that it's like French, English. I would have loved, it would have been at least make it automatic, you know, like just like, let's keep it simple, or go full stunt and make Swiss made in French.
Yeah.
Either.
I have never thought about that on a watch. And now that is going to drive me nuts. Oh my God. Wow, I've been doing this a couple years, and that's a new one for me, and I absolutely hate it. Wow.
Yeah, that's what happens when you stare at a watch for too long.
Oh, no, Danny. Oh,
you're
man.
Getting you way just broke, too pedantic.
You just broke my brain. Shit. well, I was going to give them shit about the strap, but I think yours takes the cake. Yeah, the only addition I'll have is I'll say the strap. I just think, like, I think sometimes watch brands over-engineer the straps. Like earlier I mentioned, like, you know, they feel like it's a nice watch, you should put a nice strap on it. I actually don't think the problem is that these brands are cheaping out. I think the problem is that they over-engineer it. They're going for the highest grade, super stiff alligator, and they want the edges hand-painted, and they want, you know, silver thread for the stitching. It's just like, just make something soft out of nice leather that's going to be comfortable. The moment I put it on, it's going to hug my wrist. It uses a pin buckle, which, to give them credit, they used a pin buckle here, not a deployant. Thank you.
Yep.
But yeah, just like watch brands in general, just like be cool about the straps. Like, don't try so hard. And like, even, you know what? Like, this has nothing to do with this watch, but while we're dropping requests here, like, offer options. Just let people pick their straps. Like, that's what they want anyway. It's, like, not a big deal. All right, we can leave it there. But I would say if those are the only things we want to change is the strap and maybe close the case back and maybe, like, quibble with the language of the dial text, which is a fight we're not going to win. I think this watch is doing okay.
I think so, too.
All right, this is an interesting one. You know, we this is a question we often do, and we just call it branded. If you were going to challenge another watch brand to make their version of this watch, whose would you like to see? And the interesting thing here is, like, other brands have made their version of this watch, both before this watch came out and since. You know, Patek does a version of this watch, and Longines does a version of this watch, like, very diverse brands. Whose version would you like to see?
Well, just to go even more high-low, even last year, Baltic did their version of this watch too, which I thought was pretty interesting to see.
Yeah.
And so it's definitely a design aesthetic that is popular from a historical perspective. And I think in the article you wrote, you showed off a lot of Omega advertisements where they had their own sector dials. I think Omega would crush a watch like this now, like their own sort of take on it. I think a weird comp to make to this, which is, like, a totally messed up comparison, but another week on the wrist you did was the Seamaster Railmaster, which it's not similar, but at the same time, some of the things they did are similar. And I'm talking about, like, the painted numerals, the texture of the dial. Omega also has a huge, you know, historical backlog to work with. And I think at a 37 to 39 millimeter size, they could knock something like that out of the park.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, you took the words right out of my mouth. Like, I could not agree with you more. I think Omega is the obvious runaway candidate here. Like, a modern Trezor with a sector dial would be amazing.
Yeah.
You know, especially, like, if they really did it with one of the Metis movements, you know, maybe put a little anti-magnétique on the dial. Like, they could go hard into that, like, 30s, 40s scientific thing. And I would want to buy every single one of those watches. Like, they would just be sick.
It would be amazing.
I kind of want, there's zero historical precedent for this, but, like, it popped into my mind and I couldn't get it out. I would love to see what Seiko or Grand Seiko would do with the idea of a sector dial. And, like, as far as I know, there is zero precedent in Japanese watchmaking for sector dials. Like, it is a European watchmaking thing. But, like, I'm kind of intrigued. Like, I wonder what the designers at Seiko would do if we said, like, here is all of the thought behind a sector dial. Like, here is 100 pictures of them, and here is all of the thought process that went into designing it. Do with this what you will, but give
interpret
us
it as you wish. Yeah.
Yeah. But, like, give us something grounded in these ideas and images. And, like, I think we'd get something pretty cool.
I agree. That would be awesome. Especially Grand Seiko. Like, the dial finishing would just be, like, next level. On a Grand Seiko sector dial.
It'd be so insane. All right, let's go to another named award. We're tentatively calling this the George Clooney Helen Mirren Award. This is how well does this watch age? You know, we could also call it, I guess, the Fine Wine Award if we didn't want to objectify to brilliant actors. But what the hell, why not? How do you think this watch has aged?
Before I answer, I pitched to Gray that we should call this the Paul Rudd Award, just because the man ages.
Oh.
The man doesn't age. He just
that's
doesn't.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. So, interesting.
Just had to get that in there. No, but I think would we really be having this conversation if it didn't age well? I mean, it's
fair play.
We could have been having this conversation for the exact reason that it didn't age well. But no, I think this watch ages amazingly. I think the fact that it was a special edition makes it age even better. I think the fact that it was made in a limited quantity, it's desirable for that reason. Who knows? Maybe we're tricked into loving it more because of that. I mean, you never know, you know, if something is readily available versus something that's completely not readily available. But I think just aesthetically, I come back to looking at photos of it often because I think it's a seriously, to use the overused term, timeless design. It really is.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think you know, this watch has aged exceptionally well. I think the fact that since then other brands have really come out kind of hard in the direction of sector dials, including some micro brands, like, it's really, I won't say GLC was like ahead of the curve. Like, sector dials were definitely a thing, you know, by the time this was happening. This was squarely in the middle of the trend, not starting the trend. But it also wasn't a hanger-on, you know, like, this, right, this was of the moment. You know, when I look at this watch, it kind of takes me back to 2017 and watches, and like what was going on and what the landscape was like and what our attitudes were and what was popular and what we thought was and wasn't possible. And that's kind of fun for me. And I think, you know, like you said, the fact that it was a special edition and only available for a short period of time helps. I think if you could go into a JLC boutique and buy this today, I would find it less appealing, but
right,
not substantively so. You know, it's still an amazing watch, but I do think, like, there's something nice about the fact that now it's not, there's not a crazy wait list, but, like, you also can't get one, you know?
Yeah, just straight up. I had a question. So just to, like, not to break category, I forgot when we were saying this. Did this watch have lume? I don't think it has any lume on it, right?
No, this watch has no lume.
I might have, like, retroactively add that to my, something I would change. I wouldn't put it in the hands, but I'd put little like classically styled plots around the outside edge if it was possible.
Yep. Okay. I think that's fair. I'm going to defend the no lume. I'm going to defend the no lume on this and say that I like that this watch flies in the face of the all sport watch everything mentality of the modern watch market. And the fact that it's like the hands are open worked, there's no lume on it, it has a date window. It's like it's kind of like a screw you in both directions. Like, it's not a classical dress watch, but it's also like defiantly not a modern sport watch.
And it's like, what are you doing in the dark with this watch anyway? Like,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, what are you doing? And also, I have to go back. I just said I would put it just on the dial and not on the hands. That would serve absolutely no purpose whatsoever.
I wasn't going to call bullshit on that for you, but I was going to let you ride that one out. But I'm glad you called it. Yeah. All right, let's do, we got three more categories here, and then I want to just sum a couple things up here at the end and think about where this sits in the broader week on the wrist pantheon, specifically in my very weird little oeuvre of reviews. But what's the best pairing with this watch? If you had to build a two watch collection, and let's keep it to modern watches just for the sake of simplicity here. What's another watch you would buy where you could have these two and be extremely happy forever and ever?
So this watch on its own, I would pair it with a sport watch, and I'd pair it with a specific sport watch from Rolex that kind of exemplifies this jet set mentality. So I'd go GMT Master. I'm going to go Pepsi Bezel because I think going Batman would be a little bit too much of the blue, like straight up blue, you know.
I agree.
Get some red in there. But that watch is a sport watch, but I've always thought of it as a more like cosmopolitan sport watch.
Yeah.
And I think that the personality that I'd envision myself as someone who would have these two watches is they would go really nicely together.
I think that's a great choice. I'm going to go, I thought about the GMT, I'll be honest. That was on my short list. That made it to like the final three, I would say. And for the same reason as you, I went Pepsi, not Batman. But ultimately, I think this watch would pair perfectly with the 321 Ed White Speedmaster.
Ooh, all right.
I think they both have a mid-century sensibility. I think this watch is super pared down. The other is obviously complicated. The other watch is on a bracelet. This watch is only on a strap. And I also think there's something to be said for both of those watches being immaculately finished on the outside, but having incredible engineering on the inside. And I think they both embody this sort of like understated mid-century whisper, don't yell kind of taste. And I find them extremely compelling next to one another.
That is a great choice. And also it's a good choice because on the one hand, you've got the JLC, which you can't get. And on the other hand, you've got the Ed White, which per year, you know, it's a tough get, but such a special one when you do, just knowing like what goes into making every single one of those 321 Speedmasters.
Yeah, totally agree. All right, what's your ideal use case? If you're putting this watch on and you can go anywhere in the world and be doing anything, what are you doing with this watch on?
Honestly, this is like a writer's watch. I mean, like, I'm writing a novel wearing this thing. Like, I'm traveling. I've got, like, you know, in some weird fantasy world where this makes no sense, my traveling typewriter with me, you know, like, I'm just like pounding the keys and got this thing on some like super cool strap and just getting creative.
Yeah, it's funny. You and I went the same direction on this, and we did not talk about this prior to recording.
I promise we didn't.
But I said, my notes say I would wear this on a trip to take pictures in Paris. Like, I imagine, like, I'm sitting in a wine bar, probably almost certainly with my wife. I've got, like, my camera sitting on the table. We got a bottle of wine between us. I'm wearing, like, you know, like a shirt jacket or something, like something nice, but like kind of casual nice. And it's just like things are laid back. Like, I need to know the time. The date's helpful. I'm not banging this thing around. I'm not, you know, I don't need a sport watch. I don't need any complications. I want to be able to, like, wander around the streets and not worry about it. But I also want to be able to go pop into somewhere and have, you know, a bottle of wine and some sausage and, like, chill out and look the part. So,
yeah.
I think you used the word for the GMT earlier, cosmopolitan. And I think that is very much what this watch is. Like,
definitely.
I've seen a couple of these in the wild, usually on watch guys, like at watch events, but I've seen one or two elsewhere. And, like, when I see somebody wearing this watch, my first thought is, like, that person must be interesting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It takes some thought to get into this watch and to get this watch. And, yeah, for me, it's like, it would be, not that a watch is creatively inspiring, but it can be, and this would be. I mean, I think, like, much the same that I would take my Rolex Explorer with me, you know, this watch scratches a really similar itch in a kind of slightly elevated fashion.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. All right, this is the last one of the categories, and I think I know what our answer is going to be, so we can move through this pretty quickly. One watch for life? Could this be it?
I honestly think it could be. And we all, like, I mean, I've said this on a couple of pods. Whenever I'm looking for a watch, I just, like, imagine it would be. And because I would buy this watch, by definition of, like, my own selection process, yeah, it could easily be a one watch for life.
Yeah, I totally, totally agree. You know, if I could provide one knock against this watch, is that maybe it's 50 meter water resistant. It's 5 bars, which, like, technically, sure, you could jump in a pool. It doesn't have a screw down crown. It's only 50 meters. Like, I mean, it's probably fine. But depending on what the terms of my warranty were, I either would or would not throw this on a NATO, because I actually think this on, like, a gray or dark blue NATO would look sick in the summer. But yeah, I might recommend you go out and buy, like, a G-Shock or something to go with it. But short of that, yeah, this is a one watcher for sure. I would recommend this. I have recommended this. I have, you know, I know for a fact many people have bought this because of conversations we've had. So hopefully those folks are enjoying the watch and are not mad at me. But yeah, I think this is a one watch for life for sure.
I really hope they're not mad at you too. They should be happy.
Yeah. If you're listening to this and you bought this watch because of this review and you're upset, like, seriously, hit us up. Like, let me know. Likewise, if you bought this watch and you love it because of the review, also hit us up. Go to the site, hodinkee.com, and comment on the story and let us know, or hit us up on Twitter or Instagram. I would love to know people's stories about this watch. It's kind of, like, you know, become a part of like, Hodinkee lore. You know, it's become kind of like a part of, like, the Hodinkee canon in a certain way. Like, it's a watch that I think we leaned pretty hard into when it came out, and has become kind of like a marker of our community in a certain way. So, yeah, let us know if you have this and what you think of it. Just to do one quick final wrap up. You know, I think, Danny, when looking back at this, one of the things that stands out to me is, as I try to put myself back in the headspace to review this watch, is how difficult it is to review time only and time and date watches. And for some reason, I've continuously subjected myself to this over the years, mostly because that's where my tastes lie. But, like, you know, whether it's this or the Cartier Tank American or the Omega Seamaster Railmaster you mentioned, or an IWC Portuguese, a Rolex Datejust, the Black Bay 58 from Tudor, like there's a million of them. And like,
you
I
did the Santos,
to
right, too.
And the Santos, the Santos, like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, I, again, this is where my taste is. Like, it makes total sense. But, you know, just before we let people go, you know, I think this review for me offered a way to think about how to take something simple and really get the most out of it. And I think that's where this watch itself is successful, is that it takes very little and does a lot. Does that make any sense, or am I making some like weird connection here?
No, I think it does. And I think it also explains why this, along with James Tudor GMT review, are so rewatchable and so you know, lasting. It's both of them are taking an aesthetic which is not original to them, but it's a known quantity, it's a simple design, it can be executed extremely poorly and has been by others, but individually both of those watches nail that. And I think that's just a testament to what the inexplicable nature of what makes a watch great and what makes us love them.
I couldn't have said it better myself, my friend.
That's what I'm here for. Just to say things, just to say things the best way possible.
I love it. Well, thanks for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate it. And thanks for humoring my weird nostalgic desire to look back at a story and video I did over or almost 4 years ago. To kind of, you know, I don't know, take a trip down horological memory lane.
No worries. Next week, what is Railmaster? Week after Santos, I'll be back, you know, for all the right?
We'll do a run through of all of Steven's time only or time and date weeks on the wrist. Spoiler alert, the watches are almost always steel. They almost always have a white, silver, or black dial. And my take is almost always less is actually more. Everybody now knows the series. But hopefully we'll get them to come back. We should do that as a spinoff pod, just you and me.
I'm here for it.
We could jump on Clubhouse, do it there, do something silly.
Let's do it.
Awesome. Well, thanks, man. Really appreciate it. And hope to have you back on the show soon.
Thanks, Steven.